Well, on the 8th of July, the Israeli military began Operation Protective Edge, the aerial bombardment of Gaza, and last week a ground invasion began. In the last few days, 18 Israeli soldiers have been killed in Gaza, more than 500 Palestinians, including over 100 children, have died. Now, when the fighting does cease, there'll be a lot of interest in who's gained the most from the carnage. But now we're focusing mainly on Palestinian politics and what might be the long-term political implications of the latest fighting in Gaza for Palestinian parties, principally Hamas and Fatah. One of the avowed aims of the Israelis, of course, is to get rid of Hamas, the Islamist party that controls government in Gaza. And as I said earlier, we're not sufficiently aware that it's the local branch, if you like, of the Muslim Brotherhood, which we've been discussing ad nauseum, of course, in the Egyptian context. So let's now have a calibrated look at what's going on with Hussein Ibish. He's a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, and Hussein's recent view is that neither Israel nor Hamas can win in Gaza, and that the biggest loser might be Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas, of course, runs the Palestinian Authority that controls the West Bank. Hussein joins us via Skype from his home in Washington, D.C. And I welcome you to LNL, Hussein.
Thank you very much indeed. Good to be with you.
First of all, a comment on recent happenings. It's been a pretty intense weekend with the beginnings of the ground invasion. Has either side come out with any political or military advantage at this point?
No, I don't think so. I mean, certainly the Israelis have been able to kill some people it wanted to kill and a large number of people that hopefully it didn't want to kill, including this 100 children and whatnot. And in addition to destroy some Hamas infrastructure, rockets, rocket launchers, tunnels, etc. But yeah, all of that can be rebuilt. I mean, the lesson of Gaza conflagrations past is that each time Israel is done with its military activities, because it isn't willing to reoccupy the area directly and police its streets, Hamas over time can rebuild and emerge not only armed again, but stronger than ever each time it comes back with a larger capability.
As we go to air, the UN Security Council has called for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Hussein, in the past 24 hours, so much diplomatic activity, UN Security Council meeting, the visit of Kerry. Mm-hmm. In your commentary since the conflict began, you have emphasized very much the role of Egypt in either solving or muddying the conflict. Tell us why Egypt is so significant.
Well, Egypt is central for two reasons: its political importance and its geographical location. Politically, it is, in spite of everything, still the most influential of the Arab states. And this is true across the board, but it's particularly true in Gaza. And there, Egypt's geographical location becomes central. Egypt is the only Arab state with a border directly with any part of the Palestinian territories, and that's its border with Gaza. And it's certainly the only Arab state with a border with Gaza. And so, other than Israel, the only state that has a major stay in what happens in Gaza and doesn't, and who comes in and who doesn't go out, and that kind of thing, is Egypt. Egypt is in possession of a wide range of incentives and disincentives that Hamas is interested in that nobody else really has. So when Hamas tries, for example, to bring its allies, Qatar and Turkey, into the political mix, that's interesting, but they don't have anything to offer, either Hamas or Israel, and they don't have a direct role. So in the end, I think it really is the Egyptians who are going to be crucial and central, and there's no way around it.
Okay, let's look at the other aspect of the Egyptian role, and that is, of course, its attitude to the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't think the Western commentariat is really sufficiently onto this this phenomenon or this fact, Hussein.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. Everybody in the Arab world and in the Middle East in general understands that Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood branch in Palestine. And I think that attitudes towards Hamas and towards, therefore, this current flare-up of violence with Israel are shaped by how they feel about the Muslim Brotherhood, because I think regional actors, while they're very sensitive to the suffering of civilians in Gaza, also tend to see Hamas's actions in the context of the Brotherhood movement regionally and its fortunes, whether it's rising or falling. So the Egyptians, the new Egyptian government that's been around since, in some form or another, since the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi last summer, has a very tense relationship with Hamas, because they see themselves as at war with the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt. Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine. They have a border with Egypt and its troubled Sinai region. When Morsi was overthrown, the Egyptian military swept into northern Sinai, where they say they encountered large numbers of Hamas operatives on the Egyptian side working in cahoots with Ansar Beit al-Maqdis and other insurgent and separatist extremist groups, and that they killed perhaps two dozen Hamas operatives. And since then, Egypt has shut down Hamas's smuggling tunnels. They have put a very strong embargo on goods and money passing through, and on people as well. The Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt has never been as firmly closed. And all of that, I think, contributed very strongly to Hamas's sense of desperation, which has guided them throughout this period of violence in the past couple of weeks, and makes Egypt central, because the primary demands that Hamas has on the world are actually mainly not directed at Israel. They're mainly directed at Egypt.
Yeah. This is Ellie Nell on RN, and we're listening to Hussein Ibish, who's the senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. There's some debate, Hussein, about amongst analysts of Palestinian politics about how strong Hamas is in Gaza. Tell me, what's your view of that? And incidentally, how is this organization run?
Well, first of all, let me deal with how it's run. It's run in a complex way, because it has different branches that operate supposedly in cooperation, but sometimes in competition and not quite conflict, but certainly rivalry. So you've got an external Politburo, political bureau, which nominally makes the major decisions for the organization. And that was previously based in Damascus in a kind of unified way, with a few members outside, but mainly it was centered in Damascus. The Syrian civil war really kind of cost Hamas its external base, its headquarters in Damascus, because they had to choose between their Muslim Brotherhood identity, with the Muslim Brotherhood being a core part of the Syrian groups trying to overthrow President Assad, and their, on the one hand, and their alliance with Iran and Assad on the other hand. They chose their identity, and they had to leave Syria. So since then, the Politburo, which heretofore has been preeminent in making especially political decisions, has been greatly weakened by being dispersed throughout the Middle East. I mean, some in Cairo, some in Amman, some in Qatar, some in Turkey, etc. And the longer this goes on, the more it weakens the Politburo as an institution. And that strengthens then other factions that exist, obviously political leaders on the ground in Gaza, like Ismail Haniyeh or Mahmoud Zahar or others, and also a separate entity within Hamas, which is the paramilitary organization, the Qassam Brigades, which again nominally yields to the dictates of the political leadership, especially the political bureau, but in reality has its own identity. And sometimes has made decisions that look like independent ones. It's very hard to know. The key thing about Hamas, how Hamas operates, like the other Muslim Brotherhood parties in the Middle East, is that it operates in secret. It's a secret group, and so everything we say is pretty well conjecture. As far as its strength in Gaza, it is not challenged directly in terms of its political control, because it has a lot more firepower than any other group in Gaza, and it rules by the gun. It doesn't rule by the ballot box or by consent or anything like that. It exercises force to underline its authority. Its popularity appears to be have suffered very greatly in recent years and even recent months, and particularly in Gaza. And opinion polls suggest that while it's not very popular anywhere among Palestinians, it's certainly not very popular in Gaza.
Have events of the last few days perhaps improved their political credibility or worsened it?
Well, I think in the immediate term, they've improved them. And they've improved it because they have grabbed the Palestinian flag and the bloody shirt and whatnot, and they're waving it. And in the immediate moment, when bullets are flying and passions are running high, they at least seem to have the momentum. They at least seem to have an agenda, even if it's a disastrous one. And so in the immediate term, it has given them, if nothing else, an aura of dynamism that's lacking in, say, the Palestinian Authority, which has put all of its, which has counted entirely on diplomacy and security coordination, and essentially an attitude of trying to work with Israel towards a peace agreement.
This is what I was quoting you earlier, making the point that Mahmoud Abbas is probably the big loser so far, and the Palestinian Authority is suffering what you call a crisis of legitimacy.
Yeah, I think both are suffering a crisis of legitimacy, but Hamas bypasses it through this kind of direct confrontation. Yes, of course, the PA has a crisis of legitimacy. All Palestinian leadership does, because there hasn't been an election since 2006. And both parties appear to have failed. I mean, the PLO's approach, the Fatah's approach of negotiations with Israel hasn't produced anything. Neither has Hamas's approach of confrontation. And so, you know, at a certain point, those who are interested in Hamas not being rewarded have to take into consideration that in the end of the day, there are two Palestinian political movements here that offer very different visions to the Palestinian people of how to go forward. And if Hamas is left bloodied and battered, but, you know, with something, that is to say, a policy of confrontation that at least appears dynamic, and the PA is left with nothing, which is a policy of negotiations which has produced less than nothing, that's going to send a really terrible signal. I think it's essential to pay some attention to the credibility and viability of not just President Abbas, but the PA and the PLO. To prevent that from happening. And let me just say this. It's interesting. The Egyptians and others have been careful in the past few days to promote President Abbas, to bring him center stage into the negotiations for a ceasefire, to give him that public and visible role. And it may be that in the end, even if the Egyptians and others have to give Hamas more inducements than they care to get them to agree to a ceasefire, that at least the credit would go to a very large extent to President Abbas somehow or the other. They would make sure that would happen in order to mitigate any sense that Hamas is a big victor here.
Well, politics, like nature, abhors a vacuum. Is there any possibility that the conflict leaves Gaza open for infiltration by ISIS-style groups?
Yeah, there is, of course, and we see already, a history of Salafist jihadist groups, very small, cropping up and challenging Hamas, and then they tend to get beaten down, and I mean that literally, very quickly, but they keep cropping up. When Hamas becomes sort of the center of politics, then that leaves space to their a religious and political right, which tends to go to the Salafist jihadist groups, which are now most inspired by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And so, yeah, I think there's a real danger of that, and that's certainly an Israeli fear. And one of the things I noticed that you said earlier that I think is sort of debatable is that the idea that Israel wants Hamas unseated in Gaza. I'm sure in the long run they do, but in the short run they clearly don't. In the short run, they want Hamas to stay in power in Gaza because they fear that the alternatives are anarchy or the rise of even more extreme groups, the least being Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is certainly a more extreme group, and then these, you know, other homemade, homegrown groups that keep cropping up, which resemble nothing more than ISIS. Yeah.
Hussein, last week you had an article on Foreign Affairs website, which wasn't about political divisions in the Palestinian leadership, but about splits within the Israeli cabinet. And you felt that Israeli PM Netanyahu has completely mishandled this this current war. Why is that the case? Because the Israelis seem to have inflicted vastly more damage, of course,
sure,
on the Palestinians.
Well, they have. Well, I think because the Israel is not going to accomplish anything strategic or political that is of benefit from this current round of fighting. Now, you can once you're into it, you can always find reasons for going forward. And now the kind of Israeli thinking is very much on these tunnels that have been discovered leading from northern Gaza into southern Israel in certain key places, and the potential that they have for infiltration and whatnot. Okay, so that's now the big focus. We've got to destroy, they say, these attack tunnels, they're calling them. Okay, or fine. You can always come up with something like that. But I mean, the point is that I think the Israeli military and certainly strategic thinkers who look at it dispassionately, and maybe now is not the moment for dispassion or it's asking too much, but you know, if you were to separate yourself from the passions of the moment, you'd have to recognize that unless Israel is willing to reoccupy Gaza directly, it's not going to accomplish anything in the long run that is game-changing on the ground, either politically or militarily. And I think that what the Israelis were looking to accomplish strategically was actually done in the West Bank on the ground in terms of arresting Hamas members and smashing their cells. It was done in a fairly quiet way under the rubric of looking for three kidnapped teenagers that the Israeli government knew were killed because they had audio recording of their murder on a phone call to police. Very tragic. But they withheld this information from the public, and under the guise of a search, a massive search for these boys, they conducted this gigantic crackdown. Now, I think there you can see where Israel accomplished something strategically and politically. And I think it just became very difficult for Netanyahu and the other Israeli political leaders to say to the public, once the bodies of the boys were discovered, We've front-loaded our strategic response. We've done it already. And at the same time, Hamas, I think, discovering that there wasn't going to be another uprising in the West Bank, that they couldn't get a major foothold from either the unity agreement or from this chaos that was going on in the West Bank, fell back on major rocketed attacks against Israel and taking credit for them for the first time in a couple of years. And I think between those two things, domestic political pressure and Hamas provocations, I think the Israeli government allowed itself to get sucked into a conflict that had very amorphous, very difficult to identify strategic benefits and very serious risks. And you can see those risks kicking in now. I believe that we've finally, in the past weekend, crossed into the space of diminishing returns in terms of Israel's strategic calculations, because the amount of violence that's been conducted and the amount of civilian deaths, especially deaths of children in Gaza, has reached the point where there's no way it's going to be a strategic benefit to Israel anymore. And they've got to be looking for a way out.
There is a sort of a terrible irony at the moment, though, that Netanyahu is, in a strange way, a political beneficiary of what's happened in Ukraine, because it has distracted the world from what's going on in Gaza.
I think without question, and the Ukraine in particular, this tragedy with the Malaysian airliner.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to, yeah.
I think you're right. And I would say that in all likelihood, had that incident, a terrible incident, not happened, we may well have had a ceasefire already. Now, that in a certain sense, that gives Netanyahu more space to operate if he wants it. And right now, he probably does want it because, you know, once you're in, you're in. But at a certain point, I think we're going to have, sooner rather than later, we're going to have a ceasefire because I think the point of diminishing returns for both parties has already kicked in. And it's a question now, I think, of looking for what Egypt can give Hamas that Hamas would accept and that Egypt can live with. And that's the biggest trick of all, actually. It's funny how Israel, in terms of resolving this, is very much on the sidelines, whereas in terms of defining the nature of the conflict is almost uniquely important to it.
A very lucid contribution from Hussein Abish, senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, and I should have pointed out he's talking to us from that beleaguered city of Washington, D.C. Thank you, Hussein. LNL on RN, and now I'm going to worry about your immortal soul, dear listener, and have a chat with James Boyce about the vexatious theological notion of original sin.